Hello everyone and welcome to today's GRN webinar, our employment law update. We've got quite a few new members in today, so for the benefit of those individuals, I'll give you a brief introduction about me and the GRB group. So my name's Dan Hawes, I'm the GRB group co-founder, something I set up back in 1997 with a fellow graduate. When we left a business studies degree at Brighton University. Since then, the GRB group have grown to become the go-to platform for high caliber university students, recent graduates, alumni, and employers. We have over 40 staff and over 2,000 clients across many different sectors. Companies you will have heard of and some are in attendance today, such as the Post Office, IBM, Unilever, and Ocado. Plus other several fast-growing SMEs dotted all around the UK. Now, in that time, our recruitment experts have managed to successfully match over 8,000 graduates with full-time graduate or executive level jobs. Now, the GRB group, as it's become known, and it's kind of a new look for 2021. Over the last 12 months, we've adapted and looked at new areas that we can provide services for. So this is the GRB group as it stands today. So the Graduate Recruitment Bureau is our main business, providing contingency and outsourced graduate recruitment, but not just to recruiters across many different sectors, but now we're able to supply graduates to universities who are looking to recruit postgraduates for their courses. At GRN, so this is the Graduate Recruiters Network, that we set up back in 2009, more of that in a minute, and most recently Graduate Mentor, something we've been incubating for about 5 years, and then we decided in August 2020 to launch Graduate Mentor, mainly to mitigate the effects of the pandemic for those students and graduates who we thought were really struggling with finding work. So what better than a platform that's free, where they can have 1 hour sessions with a range of mentors who kindly volunteered from a range of different companies. So very excited about Graduate Mentor. Rising Stars is our pick of the top 50 final year students from 2021. It's like a shop window to our candidate database. So many recruiters are able to have a look at CVs of particularly outstanding final year students who are really going to make a difference when they enter the workforce in the summer. We also have a monthly podcast called Student Diaries, where I interview 3 Sussex University students, just to give recruiters an idea what it's like to be a student right now in very different times. We also manage several LinkedIn groups for students, graduates, and recruiters alike. And finally, we have 2 experienced hire divisions, Cortex and Metrica. They focus on supplying graduates with 5 years experience in IT or analytical roles. So, Graduate Recruiters Network. This was set up by GRB back in January 2009, mainly for our clients. It was an opportunity for them to meet face-to-face back in the day, but also online and share experiences and best practice. We've also extended invitations to our friends and associates, notably university career staff and other organizations. The aim is to bring together HR advisors, HR business partners, recruitment directors, talent leads, that kind of level to discuss current topics presented by a mix of relevant and influential speakers now on a monthly basis with our webinars. So ultimately, we hope our members can share best practice in a confidential environment, enhance your learning and ultimately help you become better graduate recruiters. Our membership currently stands at 2,942 members, an increase of 60 in the last month. A lot of our members are FTSE 100 firms and fast-growing SMEs across all sectors. As a member, you'll receive invites to webinars such as this, other special events, access to our LinkedIn forum, our blog, surveys from time to time, and a quarterly newsletter. That's for the standard membership. If you're looking to be a VIP member, there are several other benefits, and that comes in at £299 per year. So who's in the room today? I did a word cloud here of all the job titles of everyone who's booked to come into this webinar today. And by the way, we're just short of 200 people, which is actually a record. So I've made the effort and put a jacket on today just for that reason. Now, the majority of people in the room today are manager level. They're involved with HR or talent, but also interestingly, and obviously in the legal aspects involved in recruitment. So a nice mixture of people and a very nice mixture of organizations. So we have companies such as IBM, L'Oreal, Smith & Nephew, UBS, Apple, XPO Logistics, as well as several other fast-growing SME recruiters who I've all invited in the room today to hear from our speaker. So today's agenda, in a minute we'll start hearing from Simon Block, our employment partner at JMW Solicitors. Now he's kindly offered to share over the next 30 minutes or so information about legal implications of the furlough extension, which is now been extended to September. Brexit, we can't forget about that, and employment law, and also COVID vaccinations and the workplace, plus key employment cases. So in a very short space of time, he'll give you an overview of all of those things. At the end, there'll be the opportunity for questions. So do use the chat facility within this platform. I will go through those questions at the end and put those to Simon. Now, I imagine there will be a lot of questions. So after the event, Simon will make himself available on the LinkedIn forum for any other follow-up or questions. And then by Hopperswan, we'll cover any other business and we'll let you crack on. So these are designed for very, very busy professional people. So we're going to keep this to 1 hour and it's also being recorded. So for those members who can't make it, or you may wish to listen back to it on demand, I will be uploading this to YouTube fairly soon. So delighted to welcome Simon Block, employment partner at JMW Solicitors. Now, with all our speakers, I vet them. So usually I'll go and see speakers before inviting them to the platform. And I saw Simon over a year ago at a huge recruitment event where he stood up and talked about similar things as he is today. And he's kindly offered to share his experience today. So he works at JMW Solicitors LLP. They're a top 100 law firm and they have offices in Manchester, London and Liverpool. They're a full service offering law firm. And Simon has specific working experience in the supply into the recruitment sector specifically. And he's worked with a variety of different clients since 2007. He's also worked with various other recruitment trade associations, some of them you may have heard of, APSCO, TEAM, FCSA, and of course the REC. He regularly advises on compliance issues affecting the recruitment sector, as well as advising on employment status issues. So, as I say, there will be some debate at the end. But right now, I'm going to hand over the platform to Simon for the next 30 minutes or so. And Simon, welcome to the webinar.
Thank you very much, Dan, and thank you very much for that kind introduction. I'm just going to try and share my screen, so just bear with me a moment, and let's hope that this works. Thank you very much, Dan, for asking me to speak at this event. You're quite right. The first time that you saw me speak was just around a year ago. I'm a regular speaker at the Recruitment Expo in London, which is where Dan saw me speak. I work very closely with a number of recruitment companies. I have a portfolio of recruitment companies that I work with. Don't exclusively work in the recruitment sector, but it's a mainstay that I've found myself with an expertise in over the last 10 years or so. At the Recruitment Expo, I delivered an employment update, and this is no different to that update, but it is a year further down the line, and certainly a lot has happened a year down the line. So we just move on to the next slide, Dan. So this is briefly what we're going to cover, as Dan has set up for us. We're going to talk about furlough. Who thought a year ago anybody even knew anything about furlough? Tell you now, I certainly had never even heard of the word. But we'll talk about where we're up to with the extension. No employment law update would be complete without talking about Brexit. COVID and vaccinations and the workplace is a fascinating area. There's lots been in the press about that lately, and we'll also talk about some key employment cases that have gone through the court. So we'll move on to the next slide. I promise not to try and take up more than around half an hour of your time. There is quite a lot to get through, so please try and bear with me. Lawyers are not well known for sticking to time or having not a lot to say, so I will try and whiz through. Apologies if I don't cover everything, but that, like Dan says, I'll be available for questions at the end. So we'll talk about furlough. When this was first billed, I wanted to talk about the furlough scheme that was ending in April 2021. But for those of you who keep your eye on the press and the budget, you will not have missed that last week furlough was extended as part of the budget. So we're going to talk about furlough, the furlough extension, and what that means for everybody, and what considerations that you should be making as the furlough scheme likely comes to an end at the end of September 2021. So furlough, just I'm not going to talk you through the entire of the furlough scheme, but I'll just try and dress it up for you for those of you who are not used to furlough and have never seen it operate. It's now become a common word in as part of regular parlance, furlough. Everybody now knows what it is. It was something that we never heard of a year ago, but it originated in the German army, where people were given a period of leave to go away. And how the furlough scheme now it operates is that you're allowed, for a COVID-related reason, to send home your employee. You continue to remain employed by them, and you can claim an amount in order to pay those people from the government effectively. And what the idea was behind the furlough scheme clearly is to prevent the displacement of employees and to stop people losing their jobs. Furlough is something that has to be agreed with the employee as part of their employment and as part of varying their employment contract. As part of the furlough scheme, you were able to claim effectively a subsidy. And if you wanted to, you didn't have to, you were able to top up those wages. Like I said, it was an option. It's not something that you had to do. So that just puts furlough into some brief context for you. Can we just move through those slides, Dan? So in terms of the furlough extension, as I said, that Mr. Sunak announced in the budget that the job retention scheme, coronavirus job retention scheme, would be extended in its current form until the 30th of September 2021. You will have recognised, as the furlough scheme has been in operation throughout the course of the last year, that it has changed in various formats whilst it's been in operation. And the current scheme, and the current offering, which opened on the 1st of November 2020 and is currently in place due to run till the 30th of April 2021, basically provides that employers are allowed to claim for 80% of the salary, employees' hours that they work, and up to a maximum limit of £2,500. I'm not seeing too many people on full furlough at the minute. It's now rare. Flexi furlough is something that I see regularly. So just be aware of that and just be conscious that, are you using the furlough scheme properly and for what it is intended? Because full furlough is less common now. Flexi furlough is definitely a lot more common. So in terms of the current claim, you're allowed to claim for 80%. There's no requirement for you to actually top up salary and top up the hours not worked. If people are coming to work, of course, they should be paid 100% of their wages for the time that they spend at work. In terms of the differences, in terms of the original scheme, employers still need to pay the employer's national insurance contributions and the pension contributions on the furlough employees' pay. In terms of what is going to change and what does it mean for employers in terms of the changes, we are going to see a tapered type of relief that comes into force from July, where employers will be required to contribute 10% towards the hours their employees do not work. And in August and September, employers will be required to contribute 20% towards the hours their employers do not work. And my own opinion, I expect, is that as less people are taking up the furlough, Rishi Sunak has decided and taken the view that he's got a little bit more still in the tank and therefore had this ability to try and extend the furlough, but he's going to taper the relief. So I think that they're important things and things that you really need to focus on as we move forward to July and August and September. Just in terms of a couple of changes that were made to the scheme from its pre-31st of October iteration is that if you have to make somebody redundant or let them go after the 1st of December, you can no longer claim for any days on which a person is serving statutory or contractual notice. That's really important because a lot of people were claiming for notice pay as part of the furlough scheme. And another thing to be aware of, if you weren't already, is that from February, HMRC is also publishing information about employers who are claiming for the period starting after the 1st of December. And what information HMRC are publishing is the name of the employer, an indication of the value of the claim within a banded range, and details of the company or the company number and company name. So that's really important as you claim through the scheme, because clearly there's been quite a lot of in the press about employers who have been claiming, who perhaps shouldn't have been claiming, and they're just trying to show these are the people who are claiming. So it is a consideration whether you should be claiming and how much and how many you are claiming for. I've seen plenty of employers decide we're not going to claim because we don't want the stigma attached with how it may affect our reputation if we are on that list. And I've had plenty of discussions with employers about that. Can we just move on that slide, please, if that's okay? I think there's some real key considerations that you need to think about as the furlough scheme extends and comes to an end. The Finance Act introduced a provision in respect of an amnesty the Finance Act came into force in October 2020, and it gives up an amnesty. And this is a really important point that people need to consider, because there will be plenty of times where mistakes will have been made in making furlough applications. And the government is saying that if you've claimed incorrectly, we're giving you a time within which to pay that back. Now, I'm not going to go into details about the whole time period. It's a bit confusing depending on when your claim is. But I think for the purposes of this, you've got a 90-day time period from which you claim for your current claim. Say it's, for example, the March claim, and when you receive that, to decide whether or not you've claimed incorrectly. So it's going to be really, really important as the furlough scheme comes to a conclusion that you consider that carefully. If you get it wrong, there are really some quite serious penalties that you can be subjected to if you have made civil and criminal errors. So if you make a mistake, clearly there will be penalties and interest that may be applied, but there's been plenty out there in the press about people who have claimed fraudulently and furlough fraud. And there will be, I've had some examples that has been shown to me about people who have claimed fraudulently. And there is a serious risk if that is identified and you don't surrender it, that you could be prosecuted. I think in terms of the, in the run-up to the 20th of October amnesty, the government confirmed that it had paid out somewhere in the region of £2 to £4 billion incorrectly. That's just eye-watering figures. So when they talk to you about keeping proper records, you must make sure you kept proper records and clearly looked at your applications and audited them before HMRC decide to audit you, because they will be going round in the aftermath of this, auditing for a number of years, bearing in mind how much the public purse has paid out. We've also seen a huge rise in whistleblowing claims as a result of furlough. People who have said that they've been subject to less favourable treatment in relation to requests to go on furlough and furlough claims and being asked to work when they were on furlough. So it's one to just watch out for. You can't stop somebody running off to the HMRC and telling them that I believe that I've got a whistleblow to make because somebody's claimed furlough fraudulently. I was working and they were claiming furlough. And HMRC have taken this so seriously that they've set up a government task force to tackle furlough fraud. So can we just move to the next slide, Dan? So in terms of wrapping furlough up. So I think as we move towards a conclusion of the scheme, look at what the scheme offers. Was it suitable? Was it COVID related? Have you claimed correctly? All these points that you need to audit as the scheme closed to an end. There was strict eligibility criteria right at the very beginning. If you think about like the 3-week rule that we were talking a year ago, that's gone, well gone. But there will be calculation errors that have happened, and some will just be innocent errors, but some may not be. Think about the changes that were made to the post 1st of November scheme and whether that was processed correctly. And in terms of whether furlough will end in September 21, well, furlough has been extended a number of times since it was first incepted. I never thought that we'd have an extension to September, but we have. I expect it will end in September. I really hope we will be through the worst of it by then, but I would never call never saying never. So that deals with my piece on furlough. Can we move to the next slide, if that's all right? Okay, this is a really interesting one. No jab, no job. Seen that plenty of times in the press over the last few weeks and months. Can we move to the next slide, Dan, if that's all right? So the COVID-19 vaccine remains a huge area of uncertainty for employers. There is no actual guidance at the minute in terms of what happens in employment. But let's just have a look at a couple of questions that have been put out there and that we've talked about with clients. I think there's two scenarios. Number one, can employers require staff to be vaccinated? And I think the answer to that question has to be that there must be a significant doubt over whether that can be a requirement. I've looked at lots and lots of employment contracts in my time, and I've never seen in an employment contract as part of throughout COVID, there being something in there to say, you must have a vaccination if we tell you to do it. So it all comes around back to whether it's is it going to be a lawful instruction to ask somebody to be vaccinated if they don't want to have the vaccine? It's clearly somebody's freedom of choice whether to have the vaccine. There's a human rights issues about telling people that they must be vaccinated. But there will be certain industries where, from a health and safety perspective, and in terms of protecting, for example, in a care home environment, somebody may need to have a vaccine to be able to work in that type of environment. But I think it's all going to come down to whether it's a reasonable request to have somebody vaccinated. You'll have seen in the Pimlico Plumbers case, Mr. Mullins. He was basically, he came up with this no jab, no job type of expression. I really don't think it's going to be something that you can require staff to have. And it will be something that you really want to think very carefully about if you want to implement that. What about when recruiting? I think this is an interesting point to consider, because you could make it a condition of employment that somebody have a vaccine to be able to be offered a job. But I do think that that calls into question whether or not asking somebody to have a vaccine could amount to different types of discrimination, whether it be race, that they think there's that the employee may believe or have been advised that because of their particular race or religion that they shouldn't be having the vaccine. And that's something quite valid. It's their belief, and they may believe that they shouldn't have the vaccine. Then there's also on from disability perspective, people may have had advice that because they are suffering with a particular condition which may amount to a disability, that they should not have the vaccine. You've then got the another issue about age and age discrimination. At the minute, the vaccine program is being rolled out in an age appropriate manner. And therefore trying to tell somebody that I'm only going to start offering people jobs who have had the vaccine could end up in a race discrimination claim. So I think it's not an area where you can simply say you've got to have had the vaccine to be able to come to work or to be offered a job, because I think that's going to open a whole can of worms about whether or not you are treating people less favorably. Do you want to move to the next slide, please, Dan? So what should you do? You're already likely to have carried out a COVID risk assessment, or multiple types of assessments as everything has evolved. So I think you should take the opportunity to update your risk assessment in consideration of the vaccine, when staff will be returning to the office and how that this is going to be managed. Not all staff are going to be able to return to the office immediately. And therefore remaining flexible with your workforce will allow a phased and measured return, which doesn't put excessive pressure on your safety measures and risk assessments. What about up-to-date guidance? I expect the government will have to do something about publishing guidance as they have throughout the pandemic in terms of vaccines and the workplace. They can't just let this ride out. Keep up to date with that information, and in terms of implementing any suggestions, make sure that you're keeping up to date so that you can manage the return to whatever normality looks like. And finally, as the vaccine becomes easier to get hold of, please make it easier for employees to get hold of that vaccine and to attend meetings for the vaccine or appointments with their GP. You could even go as far as making it easier in terms of if there's a stock of private vaccines that come about in the future, making it easier for employees to purchase those vaccines. So it's an area that is to be clearly kept up to date on, because it's going to change over time. I don't think it's something that you can simply just say, well, you haven't had the vaccine, you're not coming to work, and you are potentially at risk of losing your job. I think that's definitely going to cause an issue. Can we move over to the next slide, please, Dan? Brexit. Like I said, we couldn't get through an event without talking about Brexit and employment law, and what the changes are going to mean. So it's been clear for a considerable period of time that Brexit wasn't going to lead to any immediate changes to employment laws, given the UK's previous commitment to preserving workplace rights. The commitment was embodied within the EU Withdrawal Act, which included various provisions and savings provisions for EU laws. That included employment laws at the end of the Brexit transition period. So that means there are certain regulations which will be preserved, such as the TUPE legislation, working time legislation, agency worker protection. But what has remained unclear was the extent that the UK would be able to diverge from the laws after the end of the transition period, and also what the position would be on new EU directives. And those issues are now addressed in the withdrawal agreement. So in terms of, can we just move to the next slide, please? Sorry, Dan, this just gives you some idea of the points. In terms of a level playing field, under the agreement, what the parties have said is that they're not going to reduce labour and social protection below the levels that were in place as of the 31st of December, which would be in a manner which would affect trade or investment between the EU and the UK. What the EU and the UK have also discussed is that they will continue to strive to achieve protection in all of these areas. And whilst either party could be subject to rebalancing issues if there are significant divergences in the future, if they have an effect on trade, these rebalancing issues would mean that tariffs could be imposed as part of the agreement on trade. So that they can be suspended should significant divergences exist. In terms of new EU employment directives, there are a number of EU directives that are already on the horizon, which are due to be implemented this year and into 2022. For example, we've got the whistleblowing directive, the work-life balance directive, transparent and predictable working conditions directive. I think the one thing to point out here is the UK already has comprehensive protections in this area than some of our European counterparts, but it will be interesting to watch whether there is a divergence in approach as we move further forwards. And that finally brings me on to the European Court of Justice. We've got the continued influence of the ECJ is addressed in the EU Withdrawal Act rather than in the agreement. And just in terms of a reminder, the position is that for laws which are preserved by the EU Withdrawal Act, ECJ case law as of the 31st of December 2020 still remains binding on the UK courts, but any subsequent judgments are not. So that will continue to be the case unless Parliament decides that, or the Court of Appeal or Supreme Court for that matter, that they should depart from any pre-Brexit ECJ case law. And that's basically in circumstances where they think it is right to do so. So in terms of any post-Brexit decisions, they're preserved, although they're not binding. So they are nonetheless likely to be highly persuasive in the UK courts. And I expect that this is probably going to be likely with any post-transition ECJ decisions on any new employment protections, so that the UK maintains this level playing field approach. So it's a case of we're going to have to see what happens, but I can't imagine that all of a sudden, overnight, the influence of the European Court of Justice is going to disappear. Can we just move to the next slide, if that's all right? And again, and then finally, we're going to take a quick look at a couple of employment law cases. So unless you've been hiding under a rock somewhere, that you won't have missed that we had what I can only describe as the case of a case of the decade in the decision of Uber and others and Aslam, which was heard by the Supreme Court in February. I'll just talk you through some of the background to the case and how we've ended up getting here. So the case of Uber and Mr. Aslam dates back to 2016. And basically Uber has sold itself on the basis that it is not a provision, a provider of a taxi service. They have a smartphone app, as everybody will know, where passengers book rides from drivers who also have that app. The drivers own their own cars, and they're free to decide when they make themselves available to accept the bookings. And what happened is that when Uber was taking on drivers, they signed a document that clearly held themselves out as a self-employed contractor. But Mr. Aslam went further down the line and he said, this doesn't really reflect the reality of the situation that I'm in. I don't really have this freedom. I don't really have the choice as to whether I accept bookings. I'm also penalized if I don't do certain things. I don't have any ongoing relationship as a driver with the customer. I'm effectively controlled by this platform that I operate within, and I'm subject to significant constraints. Now, in terms of employment law, you'll be aware that there are three different categories of employment protection. We have self-employed individuals who virtually have no employment law protections, no statutory protections, and everything is based on what is in the contract. We then have this middle category called worker that have limited protections, but they do have protections in respect of the minimum wage, holiday pay, whistleblowing, discrimination protections. All employees are workers, but not all workers are employees. You've then got the third category of employee, which they're based on a contract of employment. They have the most statutory protection available, the right to not be unfairly dismissed, the right to a redundancy payment. They've also got special protections in relation to receiving maternity leave. So it's really important that everybody understands those different categories that we've got. When I think back to the Uber decision, I remember seeing on Newsnight that many of the drivers were actually really quite unhappy that Mr. Aslam and others were proceeding with this type of claim, because Uber drivers were really happy that they got to balance their life flexibly, many of whom had other jobs, and they considered it was significantly flexible. So I'm not sure how this decision is going to sit with all Uber drivers, really. What ended up happening at the employment tribunal, just to explain that, is that Mr. Aslam went off and claimed to be an employee. The court did not find that they were an employee, but did find that they were workers, as I've just explained. So they had limited protections, but they definitely had some protections in relation to minimum wage and holiday pay, which I expect is what they were most concerned about. The case then went on and was appealed to the Employment Appeal Tribunal and up to the Court of Appeal, both of whom agreed with the Employment Tribunal that the Employment Tribunal was right and that they were workers. There was some dissenting opinion that was expressed in the Court of Appeal. The majority was 2-1, but they still found that they were workers. But we then ended up in the Supreme Court, as I said, back in February. The hearing had been heard back in July of 2020. And they gave five reasons why these drivers were workers. And I'm not going to cover all of those technical reasons, but the summary of that is that the written contract did not actually reflect the reality of what happened in practice. And because of the amount of supervision, restriction, control that was operated by Uber, they found that they were workers. So does this case have to actually provide a single test to determine whether self-employed contractors are workers? Absolutely not. Each case is determined on its own facts. But we do now have authoritative guidance for people who are operating in the gig economy And I think that this case doesn't just apply to those who are operating in the gig economy. You will see people put the label on a contract. Plenty of time that people are self-employed, but the reality of it is that's just a label that is slapped on the contract, either by a clever lawyer or clever wording in the contract. And the reality of it is in practice, it doesn't play out like that. So that just brings you up to date with the Uber decision. So finally, I'm going to have a look at the, if we could just move that slide on, please, Dan, if that's all right. Finally, I'll look at the case of Asda, Stores and Brilliant and others. And why this is so important is this is the latest hearing in a long-running saga brought by Asda shop floor workers in the Supreme Court. So Asda has actually overtaken Sainsbury's to become the second largest supermarket and has 600 stores, 130,000 hourly paid employees on retail terms, and approximately 12,000 employees working in distribution centers on different types of terms. And what we're facing is, or what Asda are facing in this particular case, is claims from thousands of female, or mostly female, retail workers claiming that they should compare themselves to mostly male distribution depot staff. And what the claimants are arguing is that their jobs involve work of equal value to the depot employees, but the terms of the depot employees are more favorable. If the case is successful, the cost to Asda is significant, eye-watering figures. But it's not only Asda who are in the firing line. Other retailers, such as Tesco, Morrison's, Next, Sainsbury's, are also in that line too. I think I've read somewhere that the figure that's quoted in respect of Tesco's potential liability, somewhere in the region of £4 billion. So that's just an eye-watering number. So what is likely to happen, and why is it so important? If the Supreme Court, subject to what the Supreme Court decide, it will give us further guidance on comparison of the question of the same employment, particularly in respect of whether it was equal value work. And what does that therefore mean in practical terms? If Asda wins the appeal, the claims will in effect stop, that will be it. And it's likely that the claimants in this case and the funders of the claim will be forced to reconsider their claims, and the claims may therefore stop. However, if Asda loses, they'll treat that, the claimants will see this as a very positive sign, and we could expect to see many more types of claims of this nature. Given the stakes for Asda, we can also expect them to take a similar approach in relation to the various stages of the second and third stages of an equal pay claim, and challenging those matters through the appeal courts. So it's really an important case and one really to watch out for, because having seen equal pay claims go through the public sector in recent years, we're now starting to see this on large scales through the private sector, and this will just continue to be a chain reaction, I expect, subject to the outcome of this case. So I don't know how long I've been speaking there for. I hope I haven't gone too far through my allotted half an hour. But that's the end of the presentation. I'm more than happy to try and take some questions on anything that I've talked about. Are there any questions, Dan, that you've got or you can see that's been put?
Fantastic. Yes, there have been some questions. I've been making lots of notes, and firstly, thank you very much. You know, it's rare to get this kind of information explained in such a clear way. So On behalf of our members, thank you, Simon, for sharing what you have in a very short space of time. So I have got some questions. One that here that's regarding Brexit. So post-Brexit, European candidates will need visas.
Yes.
So as a sponsor, this organisation asked for an extra annual allocation of certificates that they could allocate this year and next in order for them to continue to recruit Europeans. They were refused. Do you know what immigration law is up to here?
So I can tell you very briefly that, and this is a whole topic in itself, and we do have a specific immigration team if you need specific advice on this. Have put some details in the box. Just move on to the last slide, if you don't mind, just so that everybody's got my details.
Yes.
If you want to get in touch, because this is quite an involved question. But basically, beyond the end of Brexit, there is a new points immigration-based system that will apply to most EEA nationals. I think one thing that you should consider doing is whether you've applied for pre-settled status of those individuals. But if you've got a spot, if you need sponsor licenses, and that is something that you've got or you need to put in place, that is something that you do need to get in touch about, because it's really quite an involved and specific question. So if you want to get in touch with me separately, I can put you in touch with an immigration specialist who will be able to help you.
Super, thank you. On behalf of that member, thank you very much for offering to follow up. I'm sure that, you know, it's very complicated and you need to address each yeah. of these questions with a bit more information. So hopefully you can follow up with that individual. Another question here, do you have employment law updates in a form of a newsletter from JMW or GNP?
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to get in touch, we can add my details are there. If you want to drop me a line, we do run regular bulletins and updates on blogs, so we can send those out to you.
Great. And are you planning on doing any face-to-face events in the latter half of this year? Are you aware of any big events?
We definitely operate events here in Manchester, and I know our London office do as well. We haven't made any plans as yet. Seems a bit uncertain at the minute, but we do regularly run quarterly events, and I expect as time goes by we'll be running more and more of these online so that we can reach a wider audience. So absolutely, we do run in-person events.
Lovely. That's good to know, Simon. One of the questions just come through. When furlough comes to an end, what is the next step for employers? Do you see redundancies happening then?
I'm afraid so. It's something that has already happened, that as we've been through the furlough scheme, especially right at the beginning, I saw scores of people being made redundant. And I'm afraid that a week doesn't go by where I'm not asked to advise either an individual on a terms of a settlement agreement because they're being made redundant, or to discuss with an employer about making redundancies. I'm afraid the end of furlough and the tapering of this scheme and the likelihood that it will come to an end in September, I'm afraid that we'll start to get to May and June, and people will have to start thinking as they contribute towards, or being asked to contribute towards, the furlough, if they're not already flexi furloughing individuals, the redundancies will be inevitable, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I think you're right, unfortunately. The follow-up to your answer there, same individual has said, would 1 year on furlough count as service towards redundancy?
Absolutely, yes. The contract of employment continues to subsist during furlough. So if somebody, for example, had 18 months service when they were placed on furlough, but then they'd had a whole one year on furlough, that person would come back to work with, whether they did or didn't come back to work, that person would have 2.5 years service effectively. So it absolutely does count towards continuous service, and therefore is relevant to whether or not somebody could be unfairly dismissed, and also relevant to whether or not they're entitled to statutory redundancy payment.
Right, thanks for explaining that, Simon. The gig economy and the Uber ruling, fascinating, because obviously a lot of students at university work on this basis, and some may prefer it, like some of those Uber drivers actually prefer the flexibility without having those rights as an official worker. But I guess it is generally good news for students now that they are treated equally. And you know, maybe from an employer's view, be interesting to see how they react, whether they you know, follow suit. I mean, are you seeing lots of other cases about bubbling under that are coming through, do you think?
I think I've already seen people concerned about whether their terms and conditions, especially where they're engaging people on a self-employed basis. And you see plenty of people through recruiters, I see it, where people are engaged on truly self-employed terms, not even supplying their services via a limited company, truly self-employed terms. And the question and the reality of it is not what is written in the contract. It's rather what is written in the contract reflects the reality in practice. And that is nothing new. It has always been the case that whatever you write in the contract has to reflect what happens in practice. And there's just no getting away from it. So if you think, well, what I say in the contract has no bearing on how it operates, it's time to review those terms, because you are just a sitting duck, just waiting for somebody to challenge it. And of course, people will gather momentum from the Uber case because they've seen that it does work. And okay, the challenge might not be on the scale of Uber, but it is a really, really important piece of case law. I appreciate that the gig economy, this is all focused on the gig economy and Uber drivers. And there have been others in the press, such as Deliveroo and other taxi companies. But I can see this really going through the chain to other businesses as well.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable. That's such a massive case. And as you say, in the last 10 years, no bigger than this. And Uber arguably have got away with quite a lot in that time.
Yeah.
So yeah, big, big, big case. Lovely. Okay. I'm just going to wrap up now with a few bits and pieces. So Simon has kindly agreed to jump on the GRN LinkedIn forum and answer any questions that you may have, so do visit that either today or tomorrow. The event has been recorded, so I will be updating our YouTube channel, so if you do want to listen back on demand, then visit the GRN YouTube channel. Our next webinar, date for your diary, is Wednesday the 7th of April. A real treat in store. We've got our first panel are members from John Lewis, IBM and SIA Partners, all kindly volunteered to join us for a panel Q&A talking about remote onboarding. We've just produced a white paper with about 13 of our members contributing, talking about this precise subject. So we're going to bring it to life a little bit more and give you an opportunity to ask any questions. So that's Wednesday the 7th of April, same time, 12:30. Till 1:30. So thank you very much. We look forward to meeting you again at another webinar, and have a great week. Big thanks to Simon, and all the very best.